Welcome everyone to a special episode number 75 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Jeff Taylor, a lifetime entrepreneur and founder of 15 companies, including Monster.com and most recently, RoverTrophy.com. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Jeff, thank you so much for coming up and joining us today.
Andrew, excited to be here.
Excellent. So, way back in the day, you're actually a Needham native, right?
Yep. I moved here when I was in seventh grade. I'm actually from the Midwest. I was born in Aurora, which is right outside Chicago in Illinois. And I lived there until I was nine. My dad went to Rutgers in New Jersey. And so I spent a couple years in university housing down in Jersey. And then he got a job at UMass Boston. And so both my parents were in education. My mom was a guidance counselor in the Needham school system. My dad at UMass Boston. And so my upbringing was really with an educational bent to it as opposed to a business bent, which we'll get into.
Okay. What was it like going to Needham High, being a rocket back in the day?
I would say kind of rough and tumble. I didn't come from much money. And as a youngster, I didn't have any real exposure to sports or to a lot of the things that the Needhamite would be exposed to kind of growing up here. And so I came into Needham probably underprepared for a much bigger junior high and high school system. And one of the things I talk about later in life is kind of the laws of the jungle. And I spent most of my high school experience trying to blend in to avoid being eaten. And then by the time I went to college, it was to try to stand out to attract a mate. And so a good transition, very good family life, very creative, supportive parents, both first-time college graduates, and really, I think, liberal upbringing. And they encouraged me, even with my undiagnosed ADHD that you would talk about today, and some of my outbursts and kind of not being much of a rule follower, my parents were very supportive to keep the creative side of me, not to crush it. Probably it served me extremely well later in life.
Well, I went to UMass, which was a good place for non-rule followers. Uh-huh. What'd you do while you were there?
I mean, UMass was a crazy opportunity for me. I just remember reflecting in the summer before I went to college and saying, like, look, I think I can actually bring a different side of me to the university. And so kind of reinvented myself, maybe one of the first times reinventing myself, and immediately pledged a fraternity. It was called Pi Kappa Alpha. It's interesting if you reflect on fraternity life, it gets a lot of bad press, for hazing and those kinds of things. But it was an extremely important experience for me early on. The fraternity was very focused on leadership on campus, gave me an introduction to the tour guide service, which was called Archon. And I spent a couple of years running tours. I really liked the big bullhorn tours on the weekends. And I had that introduction through the fraternity. I also had a guy who did ad sales for the UMass Collegian, which was the largest college newspaper, I think, east of the Mississippi. And I had an opportunity to start in a terrible territory and then work my way up to being the advertising and business manager of the UMass Collegian. And so I think in combination with just being a leader in my fraternity, where I was pledge master, vice president, president of the house, and then fifth exec the year after I was president, all of those experiences combined were hugely important for my development as a leader. And my entrepreneurial tendencies combined with the community, which was a city, and I kind of like rock and rolled in that city.
So speaking of rock and roll, I think it was at your fraternity that you first had your foray into being a DJ.
Yeah. Music had always been a part of my life. My earliest memories are Columbia Record Club would send these albums to our house, and we couldn't afford to buy every one of them. So we would stare at the album covers. It was the Grateful Dead and Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and the Rolling Stones. And I had some of the most wonderful music experiences just playing those albums in fifth, sixth grade on. And I had a big rock and roll influence from my parents. And that guided me into my UMass DJing experience, where all of a sudden there was disco. There was Saturday Night Fever had come out in 1977. And I went to college in 1978. We'll talk later about what that means for how old I am. So at my fraternity, there was a guy that was the guy who made the tapes, and he ended up leaving school and left me kind of with some responsibility that I wanted to make these tapes. Pretty quickly, I realized that the cassette tapes get wet and then they wouldn't work. So I started with this idea that maybe I could just play my albums down at the fraternity party. And so I set up two turntables, had a little Radio Shack mixer, and I slammed records together. And our little fraternity that probably had a cafeteria area that would hold, I don't know, 60 people comfortably would probably get 250 people in it. And we had some rocking parties. That built my confidence as a DJ. I went to a local nightclub and tried out and got a job there. And that was the beginning of my DJ career.
Now, you also came up with the idea for a freshman survival kit there.
Yeah, so I was an entrepreneur and I had access to the home address list of freshmen. And so I sent a note home to all the parents of all the freshmen saying, if you want to get your kids through exams, you might want to give them a freshman survival kit. And it was a paper bag with a toothbrush and a Snickers bar and fun stuff, you know, with a note from the parents. And we charged $13 to put that little kit at their door. So two times a year, I would actually go and deliver a few thousand of these bags. So that was a great example of being at UMass, being in a big city and figuring out how to hustle early. And between DJing at the local nightclub and working at the school paper where I was paid commissions and then doing the survival kit, I had a lot of money. One of the important things to note here is that I did all that at some point. I think I had added up that I had about 250 people reporting to me in college, but I forgot to go to class. And I laugh now, but there was a lot of naysayers, a lot of people that like realized after a while that I really wasn't a very good student. And I think the decisions I made in college were the most important decisions. And I was working on the right things, but nobody else knew that. And it really teed me up to become an entrepreneur and successful later in life.
So your DJing success there ends up winning you some gigs out here doing some pretty big venues, right?
Let's say that DJing has always been a side hustle for me. I think I DJed for 45 years and I went from DJing at UMass and I was DJing at a little barn a couple nights a week in Agunquit, but I would go to this club that was called The Club. And the DJ there was a guy named Rich, and I just hung around too often. And he's like, so who are you? You know, why are you here? And I said, I have to learn how to mix vinyl like you do. And he said, come in the afternoon. I'll sit on the dance floor, bring your favorite song, but two copies of it, and I'll help you learn how to mix. So he taught me about beats per minute and that you have 4/4 beats in a classic house song. And he taught me how to take two copies of Madonna Holiday or Michael Jackson Billie Jean and how to lay those together and to be able to mix back and forth in a certain beat range that each of those songs has. And he would sit on the floor and say, terrible, good. But he taught me how to beat mix in 1981, I think. And that was there were no DJs then. And there was nobody that, very few DJs knew how to beat mix. We were just all kind of slamming different styles of music together. And after 5 years of being at UMass, finally kind of faded away, did not graduate. I tried out in Boston in Saugus at a club called The Palace, and I tried out against 100 DJs and got the job. And then I worked a couple summers at a place called Brothers Four, and then it was called Yesterday's. And I used to DJ the pool parties and bikini muscle contest, and then into a night of playing funk and really cool music around that time. It was early 80s, so the music was so good. Then I got a job at The Palace in Saugus, first in a 1,000-person room, and then in the big room, which is called Uptown, for about 2,500 people. And then ultimately took that experience and got a job at the Metro or Avalon, which was right next to Fenway Park, which was the biggest nightclub in Boston. In order to go further, I would have probably had to go to New York. at that point. And just characteristically of DJs at that time, we would DJ the whole night. Whereas DJs today maybe play for an hour if you're a headliner, maybe you get to play for 2 hours. Very different experience where you'd have to manage the crowd for a whole night of an experience. And so I learned how to start slow beats per minute and go faster and faster. And then sometime around peak in the night, drop back down and then finish the night at a really high beats per minute with a lot of energy. And one of the things I realized is that DJing in a crowd of 3,000 people is just like being a CEO and leading a company, where you're responsible for the momentum and the emotion and the culture of that club or the culture of that company. And you're directing in that way to create the right energy and the right excitement for either the employees or, in this case, the dance floor. And people, I'm not sure, ever really related much to that kind of comparison. Even today, if I had a chance to go DJ for 10,000 people, it's an amazing feeling to be able to program to a large group like that. And it's an amazing feeling to run a successful company.
That's an interesting analogy. I think about, you know, you can't always run the company at 180 beats per minute. You know, there needs to be some crescendos and some slower parts,
right,
and some build.
And believe it or not, you don't get to control that tempo. So sometimes things happen and you have to reset. And in running a company, you have hundreds or thousands of people that individually have their own emotion and their own things going on in their lives. And so the idea to get emotion of a company where, first of all, that the company cares about its people and that the people know that that's true, I think is really where the magic begins to happen. And then secondly, is that if you really do care about your people, then you really have to know what's going on. And so there's lots of mini motion and momentum within a company. And then you have your master culture plan and product plan. And, you know, you're an entrepreneur as well. So you know what that feels like when you get the motion right and you land two or three clients at once and everything's really hot. That's an exciting time. And then you hit a lull and you have to reset and you have to motivate your employees and things happen. And so I've always loved the process. Somebody said to me 20 years after running Monster, like, what's the biggest achievement? And I would say to watch the people who have grown and become leaders and have found successes in their life because of that foundation of being at a company that was really supportive to the people and the culture.
Well, it was a life changer for me, but we'll get to that later too.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So you had a fateful meeting with a recruiter that said, hey, maybe you might want to do recruitment and search?
I met a woman in the nightclub who was a recruiter. And she said, I think you'd really like being a recruiter. I was like, I don't even really know what it is. And she basically said, you know, you recruit people, you move people from one place to another, and you charge a fee to do that. And that was a very oversimplified description of being a recruiter. But she said, look, there's a few recruiting firms on 128. Why don't you just put on a shirt and jacket and do a few interviews and see what happens? So I did. And I interviewed at four different search firms, kind of liked this idea, and I got four job offers. And what I realized is if they thought you could sell and that you'd be good on the phone, that you would get an offer. And so I all of a sudden had a choice of companies. I picked a company called Search Inc. And I went to work there, and the founder was very entrepreneurial. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm not sure. And he said, have you ever heard about programming? And I was like, I mean, I've heard a little bit about obviously computers, but not really anything specific about programming. He said, well, there's a bunch of DOS and IMS mainframes that are here on 128 and 495. And why don't you see if you can get to know some of the programmers to work that and see if you can place programmers. So that was my first real, like, random introduction into the technology world. It took me about 6 months to figure out what was going on because it was very complicated. Then I realized that there were these mainframe computers. There'd be anywhere from like 8 to 30, 40 people, programmers, around these mainframes. And they were in pockets at every one of these big companies. At that point, the 128 kind of superhighway was a very important tech area in the country. So I had an opportunity to get to know some of those programmers. Pretty quickly, I mapped the whole developer community on 128. So I spent the next couple of years with some successes placing programmers. My dad had this conversation with me that I remember very well. And he said, so what do you actually do? And it was back to that simple description. I kind of move programmers from one company to another company and I make a fee. And he said, what part of the job is really intriguing you? And I said, I write ads that combine maybe 6 or 8 or 10 of my job descriptions into one description. I put that in the newspaper. And then anybody that answers that, I field those people into all the different jobs that I have. He said, why don't you think about doing something with that? And I remembered my client saying, what should I do with my ads? Because I can't use a recruiting firm until I advertise in the paper at that point. And I would say, you got to make your ads more technical. Your ads are boring. So they would write more technical ads and then the ads would work. And then I wouldn't be able to place my programmers with that company. I talked to my dad about this and he said, why don't you try to combine those things? Turns out one of my fraternity brothers, his name is Jim Goldman, ran a recruitment firm, a help wanted ad agency, placed help wanted ads for companies in the Boston Globe. So I went and met with him and he's like, sure, why don't you come work with me? I worked with him for a few years and we grew the firm together to about maybe 80 or 90 people. And many of those employees then reported to me. I went to him and said, would you be interested in sharing a little bit of ownership in the company? And he said, no. So I left and started my own ad agency, which was called Adion. And ads was what we did, and an ion was a particle of energy. And so this name Adion formed. I did human resource communication. So I did recruitment, but I also did a number of other programs for HR. That moment was important because I got my first angel investors. I got my first idea where I had other people put money into my idea. And I also named a company, not Taylor Advertising, because what I decided was if I call it Taylor Advertising, I looked up, there were like 500 service agencies in Massachusetts. They were almost all called the names of the people. You know, it'd be like Smith and Lewis and Taylor. I decided that I thought if I could brand a company, first of all, it would expand the market just by people talking about it. And also people wouldn't say, where is Taylor? So I could actually have multiple people out representing the name and the brand Adion. And so that's what I did. And that worked very well.
Was it hard to do? Did you have any doubts or imposter syndrome when you were first starting? Like, how'd you find the confidence to do that?
You know, it's funny. If people don't know me, some might say, okay, you know, Jeff's got like a big ego. And the reality is that I'm extremely passionate. And that passion goes right to the edge of ego. And I'm sure that everyone has an ego, but the confidence that I think is just like born in me. I always had perseverance and determination. When everyone else gets tired, I am not tired. And then when everyone else is done, I still have another gear. And that has defined me through my life. People always say, you know, I don't need to work hard. I graduated from college. I just work smart. And it's like, no, actually working smart is what got you the job and keeps you in the job. It was working hard is how you can kind of redefine yourself. And so I always felt that the sweat equity was the most valuable in my own efforts.
I think Michael Jordan would say the same thing.
I'm not sure I get the quote right, but it's like he missed the winning shot something like 300 times. I just love that deep strength of character.
So while you're growing Adion, one of your customers, Andy Norman, says to you, hey, I think I might have to fire you if you don't come up with something better than the newspapers.
I ended up working with some of the hottest companies in Boston, and I worked in particular in high tech and biotech and healthcare. So I had like Mass General and Beth Israel Hospital during the nursing shortages, and they were my customers. I had 10 of the big biotech companies where I placed their recruitment advertising. And in the high tech area, I had this small company that was called Wellfleet Communications. Wellfleet for a while was the hot company. They ended up placing like full page ads in the Boston Globe. And those partnerships defined my experience. And one of my big HR leaders was a guy named Andy Norman at Wellfleet. And he said, the newspaper's not working. He said, look, you need to come up with something. If you don't come up with something, I'm going to have to go elsewhere. And I had read about bulletin boards. And they were saying that these BBSs, some engineers were talking with one another. And my dad was at UMass Boston. And he said, you know, this email address is really interesting as a way to communicate. Why don't you get an email address? So the only email address I could get was actually through UMass Boston. He got me an email address. And then we started communicating. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I can build a bulletin board. And I can set it up so that when engineers are talking to one another, maybe I can do some advertising, or maybe I just get into those conversations, see if I can get some of those engineers. So in my ad agency, we had this concept of a big idea, a monster idea. And I was like, look, what our clients need is a big idea. And if we get that idea, everything else is just kind of the support to get that idea done. And then we'll win that client and we'll service that client. One of our clients said, we need a monster idea, because they knew this approach. So I'm dreaming that I'm building a bulletin board system that's a monster idea, the monster board. That's a cool name for my bulletin board. So I have a pad next to my bed, and in the dark, I write ideas down. So I wrote the monster board in the dark on this pad. I'm closing my eyes right now. It's funny. And I couldn't sleep. And I'm like, I'm going to be upset if I can't read my handwriting, because sometimes in the morning, I can't remember what I was dreaming. So I got up around 5 o'clock. I went to a coffee shop and I wrote the interface for Monster. And I drew the first really bad monster. My kids were young then, and we were into dinosaurs. So this monster had a trumpet, and it was to trumpet the success. So it was like big, not scary, like dinosaurs for kids. And so I drew the first monster, Trumposaurus, and I wrote the interface, which was a buyer-seller interface, which was job postings and companies listing and people looking for jobs. I still have that interface. I got 3 patents from that interface. And I went into my ad agency. One of my employees, name's Alan Downing. I remembered his portfolio from college, and he had these cool drawings of animals. He was amazing with like colored pencils. And I said, could you create this monster? So I took my really chicken scratchy thing, and then he created the green monster as pretty much as we know it today. So I went back to Andy, and I had started the monster board. I was starting to ask companies if they'd like to be part of it. And Andy said, not only do I not like the name, but it's not going to work, because no one will look for a job while they're working. Maybe we get to that, but the busiest time to look for a job is after lunch on Mondays. All around the world, you know, when Monster was, you know, doing 42 million job seekers a month, Monday afternoon after lunch, you come back and you think that's the most empowered time for employees, but that's the time when they're like, I'm out.
I gotta get out of here.
I'm out. And so they would go and look for a job on Monster. So I've had plenty of conversations with Andy over the years. He's a cherished friend. He was both a motivator for me and then also a naysayer and then ultimately a believer. And, you know, it's a good experience.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So you end up taking this idea of a BBS. You work with the BBNN people, but they don't really get it / help you. And then you find someone to help you make it a reality.
So somebody says, you should go to Bolt, Berniak, and Newman. They've designed some of the backbone for the internet, and go talk to their engineers. So I went and spent a day there. I started out, one of the engineer managers said, you know, come in and you can just talk to the group. And by about 3 p.m, they basically were kicking me out. It's like, I've asked questions for 6 hours straight. And they said, there's a little consulting company that's called Net Damon's Associates. And a woman named Jenny Lawton and a guy named Chris Caldwell were two of the principals of this very small firm. It was probably a 3-person firm or something. So they said, you should call them. So I called them. They came and met with me. I showed them my drawings. I think they thought I was whacked, but I was a client. You know what that's like. And so they started building what I wanted them to build. And we built and built and built. And they built the first version of the bulletin board system in Perl scripts. While we were doing that, Mark Andreessen was at the University of Illinois. He was a grad student, and he developed something called Mozilla, and it was the first graphical interface for the internet. And I'm like, okay, I had this vision of having monsters all around this bulletin board system. It was using Lynx and Gopher and some of these older systems, but you couldn't use graphics. And this guy, Mark Andreessen, built this browser that you could actually have graphics. And he had a graphic up. And I'm like, okay, we're switching from a bulletin board system to this Mozilla page. And we built the first Mozilla page. And it was like, I don't know, probably the equivalent of like 8 feet long. And we had an area for college students. And we had the first monster board, www.monster.com, with our name, the monster board. Now, this is a bit crazy, but somebody says to me, you have to register your name. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They said, there's a crawler at MIT. It hasn't picked you up yet. And so there were only 200 websites in the world when I started Monster. And by the time I got listed in that crawler, we were the 454th.com. Just think about that for a moment. There's probably 500 million websites today. It was as raw and kind of new as it gets.
You had to trailblaze too. You told me a story about Alan comes up with this nice looking monster.
Oh yeah.
But it takes like 45 minutes to ship right. It to the server.
So the first monster, Trumposaurus, I needed a server to house my website and I needed a 56K line. So I got that installed. And then Alan has this artwork on his computer and I'm like, send it over the internet to the server. And so we sent it and nothing happened. 45 minutes later, it arrived at our server. And I'm like, okay, this is crazy. So immediately people said, well, you're not gonna be able to have graphics. And I'm like, no way. We're going to have graphics, but we'll limit the graphics. So my first designs had all the monsters. And I said, okay, we have to pick a hero. So the hero was Trumposaurus. That was our lead monster. So I started shifting to lighten up the graphics, but there was no compression software. There was nothing like what you have today. One of the early complaints for Monster was our site was slow. And part of why it was slow is because it had this graphical interface. But I felt that that was an important differentiator. And then let's talk just for a minute about the name Monster. I'm first telling my wife, and my wife basically said she wouldn't leave the house with me if I called the business Monster. She's not my wife anymore. And I went to my employees, talked with them about it, and they said, no, it's like the monster under your bed. It's like scary. I'm like, no, it's like a monster home run. It's like a walk-off home run. It's huge. And so what I said is like big, not scary. I want this to be a big jobs database. We have to make a promise that we'll have to deliver on. We had like 200 jobs at that point. And then Andy Norman's saying like, I don't like the name. Like, you know, like, so my biggest client is saying, I don't like it. You know, this gets to like a core principle, which is it's really lonely being an entrepreneur. You have to find the fortitude to believe in your idea, because if you don't believe in that idea and you listen to the people around you, you're not going to do anything. If you think it's the right thing, you need to find the horsepower to do it. 20 years later, if you want to look at the single most important responsibility that I had as an early entrepreneur, it was to protect that name. I had a couple situations where that name could have been crushed. But the key differentiator, the thing that if we had been called career this or job that, I would have been one of 10. Even though I was early in the founding of this and had the innovator opportunity because I was innovating the entire space as we were creating it, I would have been lost in the sea if I hadn't called it Monster. Once Monster started to get good, it was a key thing that propelled us forward, is because people would say, oh, go to Monster. They wouldn't say go to the job site. You wouldn't know what they were talking about. But you say go to Monster, and our address was monster.com. So that was key. A couple early stories at the beginning. One was somebody said, your monsters are all male. I'm like, so we got in a room, probably our first really critical meeting where we just had no idea what to do. We put all the monsters on the wall. It's like, okay, I don't see any sort of anatomy here, but maybe there's some spiritual representation of maleness here. So we made Nettie, which was our first androgynous, but maybe a little bit more female monster. I always felt awkward about that. Like, I don't really know. I didn't know where to start or finish in that conversation. While we were doing that, we got a cease and desist from Donald Trump. Holy shit. We get this note that basically says you have to change the name of your monster because he's called Trump. It's like, okay, well, first of all, his name's Trumposaurus. So we get together and we craft this note that basically says, if you can get Donald Duck to change his first name, we'll change our monster's nickname. And we sent that back to the Trump people, and we never heard from him again. Those were two like early stories. The other thing is, right away, I started advertising. Surprise, surprise. And so WBZ Radio was really interested in the internet. I did a big talk for about 500 people and talked about the internet. And I did some advertising on WBZ Radio as part of that kind of package. It was the first time there was a URL on the radio. And the announcer did the commercial and talked about our jobs thing and Monster, and then said www.monster.com. And I somehow missed it. And so it kind of ended up on the radio. It wasn't quite that bad, but it wasn't www. It was like a little awkward. We're running kind of a bunch of impressions, getting it out there. And I got two emails. Early emails into the server. And the first one was like, get the hell off of the radio with this URL. You're going to poison this thing or whatever. And I got another one that was like, you go, girl. Like, this is amazing, right? And I think we're actually recognized as a part of the early innovation that we had the first URL on the radio. These are kind of early stories. These are either interesting or part of that kind of initial founding, you know?
So you meet another Andy that kind of causes you to shift gears and really start growing. What was that like?
All right. So 18 months in, Monster's not doing very well. The jobs are all in Boston. The applicants are all like from India and Peru and China. And my clients are clearly struggling to even know how to deal with these resumes. So a few of my clients are saying, take my jobs down. It's not working. And I was like, I think I'd given the first 200 jobs away for free. And I think I was charging $50 a job. And so I'm struggling, but I'm not spending any time in my ad agency. My angel investors come to me and say, you have to shut this monster thing down. It's taking too much of your time and you're taking your eye off the ball of the ad agency. I look around and I'm like, this is a big idea. It is so much bigger than the ad agency, which was such a good ad agency, but there's just no way I could shut it down. So I went to the Boston Globe and said, would you like to buy half of Monster? I had three presentations. After much trepidation, not much communication with me, but internally, they came back and said our great grandfathers would roll over in their graves if we were to go and partner with the most profitable section of our newspaper, with you and a company called Monster. So that was also an amazing moment because my investors in my ad agency are saying, you have to shut this down. And my main newspaper that I'm a big client for, because I'm placing lots of recruitment ads, has just considered and then said no. And so I'm kind of running out of options. And Andy McKelvey, a New York entrepreneur who had rolled up about 15 yellow page advertising agencies and was finding some success with that, started rolling up recruitment advertising agencies like my agency, Adion. He had approached me the year before with a not very good offer, and I had said, no, thank you. So he approached me again right about this same time. And so I said, okay, let's talk. I met with him and he really wanted my ad agency and he really wanted me to run New England. I told him about Monster. So he came and spent a day with me. I had a Spark 5 and it was grinding and groaning. It was not happy. And, he said, I'll buy your ad agency. And I guess if you want to throw in Monster, we'll do something with Monster too. But we're going to change the name. So I said, flat out, no. I said, there's no way I'm going to do the deal, sell my ad agency and sell Monster if you tell me I have to change the name. I've got to convince you of this. So he spent a couple hours with me and we went through and I explained what I thought the Monster branding would be. And he came back around and started to believe in the name, said, okay. And I said, look, if we do this, I want to run your interactive part of your agency. And I want Monster to be the kind of highlight of that. He also, in support of this, what else do you need? And I said, I need a Spark 20, which is a bigger server. And he said, buy two. So that was, as an entrepreneur talking with me as an entrepreneur, the right signals. And so I sold my ad agency for a really good multiple. And I sold Monster for under $1 million. So that is another very important moment in my personal career, because I went on to make Andy McKelvey a billionaire. And I did fine, but I didn't make anywhere near that kind of money. And in my contract, I said, if we were to take this public, you would need to give me $1 million. So when we went public, I got that. But boy, did I realize how short-sighted that was. But there were no internet millionaires at that point. I just want you to have a little sense. There was no Amazon. Yahoo was started while I was running Monster in that first year. Any of the companies today that you would consider, you know, leaders in the internet world weren't even in existence. So this is very early. You got to just remember this situation. My investors want out. They're not happy that I want to keep Monster going. So they're like, maybe you should sell the business. The boss at Globus said no. And Andy's coming saying, I have a network of recruitment advertising agencies across the country, and I'll make Monster the back end. As he became a believer, I'll make Monster the back end of all of those recruitment agencies. And I was like, okay, now I get my key differentiator, the one that will, I think, propel us forward in terms of having jobs in all these different cities. And that was, I think it was a key moment in Monster's success. It was also a key moment for me because I went on and for the next 10 years, I ran Monster. The company TMP Worldwide that Andy McKelvey worked for was renamed Monster Worldwide. And my division, which started with about 17 employees, ended up having almost 10,000 employees and what became the entire company. The reflection for me on that was that I became known worldwide as the founder of Monster. I spoke and I had the clout for 484 of the Fortune 500 customers were our customers at Monster. And I was a key liaison with those and speaking to groups of 20 and 30,000 people about the impact of the internet and marketing on the internet and going on to do Super Bowl advertising and all the things we did. So I got everything except for the billion after my name. I don't have one regret about that. It's been a fantastic experience, but that was a learning moment that if I were going to do it again, I might play it a little bit differently, but I wouldn't have changed any of those major decisions.
Folks, we did a Monster double interview with Jeff today and had so much good content, it didn't fit in one episode. The story continues in a special bonus episode called A Monster Bonus. You can find that bonus episode and all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and of course, our website, underserved.fm. Download it now to continue our conversation. Until then.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved Podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.